So yesterday they basically have shown that how to quantize the holonomies curvature into in terms of holonomies, and that was a simple result that a curvature associated to a given region is given by the holonomy associated to a curve surrounding this region. And I told you that in fact something like delta function in the curvature constraint we can understand as the group delta function peaked on one for the holonomy around this curve surrounding this region where you want to impose flatness. And so I told you about this triangulation, which is a triangulation of the sphere. Actually, it happens also to be the dual triangulation of a sphere. It's dual to a tetrahedron. And so we take this as basically what we do now is to take as a spatial kind of spatial hypersurface, a sphere, and we want to impose constraints on the sphere. And we do that in this kind of, it's not the simplest, but one of the simpler triangulation of the sphere, which is the tetrahedron. And as I mentioned, for 2 plus 1 gravity, this discretization will not matter. It's a completely different issue for 3 plus 1, of course. And then we have this dual triangulation. And on this dual triangulation, so basically, this is the graph where the holonomies are defined. So you see actually that from on this graph, you can define different kinds of closed curves. But basically, one also knows that one only needs to incorporate the most elementary loops. So basically, there's actually even a notion of a first fundamental group or a first fundamental loop group. So basically, you have always a basis of loops. And you just need to consider the delta function for this basis, because if you impose that the holonomy for these basis is one, you get all other loops by combining these holonomies, and so they are automatically one. This picture needs this numbering. So let's consider kind of this example where you have these vertices. I'm not thinking. Apparently, this is D. And what we need is an orientation for later reference for all these edges. Then there's a standard enumeration for this tetrahedron. As you will see, this will lead to a standard object. So I numbered you the edges, G6. And so one basically has these are called faces. And we have these three loops. And actually, we have also, so basically, these are the three loops which are obvious. Actually, there's also a fourth one. Which is the one on the basically, which would be kind of the face on the bottom of this tetrahedron, of this dual tetrahedron. And so you would think that what you have to impose is a delta function, like faces for all these faces. So let me call that of the tetrahedron, so that this would be the constraints. However, as you might guess from the picture, do you think that all these four loops are independent? So yes or no? No. So take there's this fourth loop, and you can write it really as a product of these three loops. And so the only thing which happens is that you get also an additional conjugation. Basically, so one can actually show that these are the colonomies around the faces. If you define it properly, so I would have to give you all the initial points. Of these loops is a bit annoying. So there's one choice where basically the last orange loop you get from this combination of these three basic loops, but you need also to conjugate by the last element, G2. but this conjugation does not matter. If these three ones are equal to one, then any conjugation of one should also give you one, so that does not matter for flat geometry, for flat geometries at least. And this is an interesting fact. So actually, it holds for any spherical surface. so also, if you take a whatever cube, then it a priori has six faces, but you need only to impose flatness constraints on five of the faces, because you can get basically the loops kind of for the last loop as a combination of all the other loops. And actually, this is an integral version of the Bianchi identity. Which basically says that the differential of f is equal to zero. And so it actually tells you if you integrate the curvature around an entire surface, you get zero in this case. That's actually the Euler identity for scalar curvature. and there's a deeper connection I will only mention here, namely, if you manage, we will discuss today, probably the path integral. It will have lots of divergences which come basically from the diffeomorphism symmetry. and the diffeomorphisms, I mean, these divergences come from the diffeomorphism symmetry for the simple reason that diffeomorphism symmetry tells you have constant directions in your path integral. If you integrate over them, you get infinities. And the diffeomorphism symmetry, actually, you have that in an integral due to an identity, which is actually the Bianchi identity. And that's at some point we discussed it in these things which were called Noether theorem. There was a second Noether theorem, and then I defined something which was called generalized Bianchi identity. And so you see that there's some connection that the Bianchi identity is this mathematical identity which ensures that basically, in fact, your action is invariant under diffeomorphism. On the other hand, the Bianchi identity tells you that here, if you would impose all delta functions, it means that one delta function is too much. If you evaluate a delta function which is not independent, you get an infinity. So in effect, there is this correspondence between taking too many delta functions and having this diffeomorphic symmetry. And kind of common theme to that is the Bianchi identity. okay. And as you might know, that comes actually from the fact, from this principle that the boundary of a boundary, I don't know, is zero. And here, basically, f is a differential of the connection. But if you take the boundary of a boundary of the thing, so basically of the cube, you get zero. Okay, that's an aside, but it explains you that a priori you could get many infinities, and in fact the path integral is basically infinite, and you have to regularize that. And then for these things, for this regularization, it's important to understand the dependence of these delta functions. But let's go on, and so in principle really compute these funny things, which had this confusing name, transition amplitudes, for this basically case, for this triangulation. And these transition amplitudes were basically defined as a physical inner product between projected state. So let's maybe abbreviate this with the projector. I don't know, I could write projector f equal to zero. It's not a projector, it's because of this problem with infinities. And this is basically three phases, 3f. Okay, and we defined this for a spin network psi j. We can basically So what I do take here, let me call it A, is one basis spin network that's uniquely defined on this closed tetrahedron, and if I specify six spin values. So I call that psi A, and then I basically construct a physical state out of it. Let's call that GA, JB, because it kind of starts from here and then goes there. And I basically look into the transition amplitude between the physical state, which I get by projecting something with six spins, JA. And then I take the inner product with this physical state I get by projecting something with JBs. And so yesterday we basically discussed this, that this is given by taking the state and taking the kinematic inner product, but here we would impose, so these are basically 3Fs, the constraint, so that means that we would have to multiply with the delta functions our spin network things. And so this is what one can now compute explicitly. So I can write it out. It's a bit annoying. So let me just write out this. Everything is well defined. So let me just write out what this is. And this we had kind of two lectures ago. And so basically it was saying that I get a 3j n symbol for every vertex here. And then if I have an ingoing edge in a vertex, I need actually to take something like a dual representation into account, which means that I get a sign and a minus sign. And every edge comes with an outgoing and an ingoing edge, outgoing and ingoing end, obviously. So what you get is a minus sign for every edge. And then you get this 3JN symbols, and it's very instructive to write them down. And so the reason why this is annoying, I mean, it's slightly annoying, and that's why people use usually kind of just graphical calculus, because it's annoying. Here, basically, the problem is that everything comes with annoying signs. So actually, here one made a rule that, for instance, all the vertices are cyclic, have to be taken in, I guess, anticlockwise order. Because if you randomly commute, if you change the order, you get a sign. If you change the order in a way which is not cyclic, you get a sign. 1, 2, 3, one is missing. Okay, so this would be all the 3JN symbols. Then you would get, in principle, the dimension factors, which come from the normalization D. And then you would also get the actual matrix elements of these group representations. And so this gives you this basic state for a tetrahedron. So it just depends on these 6 spins. I mean, this is parametrized, sorry. It's parametrized by these 6 spins. And as arguments, it still has the holonomies around here. So now one can go on and basically really evaluate this kinematical inner product explicitly, and this kinematical inner product is actually still defined with even without using gauge fixing. So the lengthy way would be to write out these delta functions and these group elements G, and then you would solve for these delta functions. In the sense that you have to select, in this case, it's 3 delta functions. So you select 3 group elements and solve for them and put them into these states. And then we have six group elements. We have solved for three group elements. So you are left over with three integrations. However, these integrations actually correspond to gauge freedoms, because here we actually have four gauge freedoms, four vertices. You can basically play around and gauge fix. And actually, not all of these four are necessarily independent. That's the same as with the Bianca identity. There's a bit of dual picture to that. So, and these basically, the remaining three integrations are basically completely eaten up by the gauge freedoms associated to the vertices. And so you can actually also first go on and gauge fix three of these group elements to one. And usually that's called by choosing a tree, just that there are already too many colors to that. So for instance, you can apply gauge fixing so that this edge would be equal to one, has group element one. And you can also do that with this edge and with this edge. And so the important thing about this gauge fixing is that you haven't, you have not fixed any loop so far. So now basically you have a delta function for this phase. This you use to fix this thing to one. So this is fixed by a delta function. Then for this phase, you can fix this also to one by the delta function. And then there's this thing left, which you also fix to one by the delta function. And automatically, the other thing is satisfied to be equal to one. So you can write this out. It's actually done in the script, and do this explicitly and gauge fix and so on. And in the end, you will find that what happens is that this integral with the delta function in there, what it imposes is that you basically get the result of putting these group elements all equal to one. Again, it was the other way around. So we found that this is equal to setting basically these arguments. This is complex conjugated just because of this definition in the all to one in the kinematical inner product, or in general in the inner product. Okay, that's not too difficult to set it to one. So if you set it to one, what do you get? Representation matrices evaluated at the one, at the identity element of the group. Yeah, maybe you should get the identity matrix. Identity matrix, how does it look like? Must be the summer, probably. There's lots of ones on the diagonal, if I remember correctly, and nothing on the non-diagonal, so it's a Kronecker delta. And so for you get just a bunch of Kronecker deltas, which means that you basically can easily do one all two. You can o easily do the summations over all Qs. And so all these things together, what you get is that you still get these dimension factors. And the rest of it, so basically summation over p, and you replace every q with a p, with the corresponding p, is defined to be the so-called sixth J symbol. And yeah, there's really two definitions of six J symbols out there. One has to be a bit careful. I have a J3 here, J4, J5, J6. And so that's also something which has been known before in recoupling theory and gives you basically a basis transformation between the two coupling schemes possible for four spins. In any case, let's just define this. It's obviously something which just depends on six spins, has certain symmetries, and is associated to the tetrahedron, and is exactly associated to this tetrahedral network labeled by six spins. So basically, we get this result, and now I basically could just write this explicitly, and that's result you get. It also happens that so here you would put it also happens that the six J symbols are real, because at some point I mentioned that the three J M symbols are real. And so the six J symbols are also real. Actually, only if you define make certain phase conventions, which we assume that we do these. Okay, so now you basically have solved quantum gravity in 2+1 on a sphere. And you could say, ah, we have only done it for a tetrahedron. But in fact, it turns out that this already gives you all the results which you can know for a sphere. And that's one of the That's the following reason. So we had phi b, phi a. So what do you notice about this inner product? That's true, it's real. That's not, I mean, it's real for basically, yeah, not arbitrary states. You could put complex coefficients in front of your basis, but it's real for all basis states. Has something else peculiar about this inner product? Like if you think, okay, if you have a one-dimensional vector space and takes the inner product and compare that with a two-dimensional vector space and it takes the inner product. like in two dimensions. Always this. So typically, you know, I mean, the inner product has something which involves, has a factor which involves both entries, A and B here, which is the cosine of the angle. If you're in one dimension, you only have these two numbers.
So you can separate it into.
Yeah, I mean, okay, if you have one dimension, you might also have a sine. That's the only thing you get. But here it's in fact it is factorizing. It's you basically have only term. I mean it's basically here. You know you take just the two wave functions and evaluate it at a certain group element, and it's actually factorizing. And so this. But we start with a Hilbert space which is infinite dimensional because we have infinitely many basis choices for your basis element here. Nevertheless, you project, I mean, then we have defined that here there's this funny pseudo projector. So that actually means that the projector projects onto one dimensional Hilbert space. And so, in fact, and this Hilbert space is equivalent to C. And in fact, for a sphere, the point is that the physical Hilbert space is one dimensional. So that makes it maybe not extremely interesting for asking extremely interesting questions. Nevertheless, we computed this funny transition amplitude. So the question is, what does it mean? And to a large extent, I will leave you with this question. We basically said you can see these things as transition amplitudes, but it's actually with respect in the parameterized particle, it was only a transition amplitude in the standard sense. If you have chosen states of a very particular form, which were not even in the kinematical Hilbert space, which had these delta functions speed on time, and in the other cases, it's kind of transition amplitudes. It's rather kind of superpositions of lots of transition amplitudes. So here you can basically see that as a superposition of lots of transition amplitudes. There's this thing which you mentioned. In fact, it's real. And it's a transition amplitude in time, but there's no phase factor associated to it. So, and in fact, it turns out that kind of forward evolution is the same as backward evolution. And that what you get in an asymptotic analysis is, which I discuss later, is that we don't get really exponential of minus I action, but what we do get is, or plus, whatever. And in any case, we get the linear combination of plus and minus, which gives me a cosine of this action. And this comes roughly about because we integrate over both positive and time-like direction. And roughly, you can understand this as integrating as if you impose basically the delta function on the constraint. You would integrate over both Lagrange multipliers with positive and negative labs. That's how the Lagrange multiplier for the time is defined. And what basically imposes constraint by integrating both over both orientations, time orientations. And this is basically a feature which you see kind of In particular, in this first order formalism where you introduce the tetrads, which can also have both orientations of spacetime. So actually, this means that you integrate over both orientations for each tetrad, for each tetrahedron, for each spacetime, for each tetrahedron. And we could say it's maybe a bit weird, but that's what happens. Okay, so these are, this is the result, and basically what you can do, let's say, okay, if I set basically all spins to zero, and consider basically the physical inner product, and we had this interpretation of spins being the length. So here, would, if it has any like interpretation of transition amplitude, you transition from a point or nothing. That's basically the state, yeah, which doesn't depend on anything because everything is zero. So you would just get a constant function on the holonomies to something that is finite length. And then you just get the one sec j symbol, which is associated to this one tetrahedron. So it basically comes from nothing, from one point. That's a transition for the Big Bang. I told you, I don't really know what it means in all details. Or the transition the other way around. And actually, you know, it looks very similar to so-called Hartle-Hawking states, which, however, are much more complicated because they actually defined a Lorentzian signature. And he would basically transition from nothing by actually putting an Euclidean, kind of Euclidean cap on the Lorentzian manifold. Here we are completely Euclidean. So that's why we can do that. For a Lorentzian matrix, it's actually not really possible to have a Lorentzian matrix except for the Big Bang, where you basically have nothing here. That's why here you need to be Euclidean. Okay, so now you computed basically the transition amplitude for the Big Bang, as I might try to motivate, but this will be quite fast. The nice thing is that, in fact, in these topological series, and it was, this result was so intriguing that people believed that to hold also for non-topological series, for 4D gravity. Actually, this thing turned out to already give you basically the path integral amplitude. And in fact, you can see that as basically the amplitude of one tetrahedron being born. And so if you want to get something more complicated for a lot, like a spacetime with more tetrahedra born, means you have to actually take kind of sum over all these amplitudes. That's what I'm going to derive in a minute. Or something else I forgot to say. Okay. Let's maybe, the else I wanted to say. So this holds for a spherical surface that the Hilbert space is one dimensional. And David is not here, but apparently he told me he now understands how to do the torus exercise in the script. So in the torus case, you get actually higher dimensional Hilbert space, which is again infinite dimensional, but actually corresponds in this context of Lie groups just to finite dimensional phase space. But in the script, you have this exercise to do everything for Z2, which is a bit simpler than the Lie group SU2. And in this case, you get also finite dimensional Hilbert space. So there, you would actually not get the structure of the transition amplitudes. I don't think I asked there for huge computes and transition amplitudes, but of course you can define the transition amplitudes and consider the transition amplitudes. And then you would get a bit more interesting information and ask this to describe there in case you happen to go to the quantum information or condensed matter star courses. They all discuss this Torrey code. So that's for Z2. And if you want to do quantum gravity, you actually have to do SU2. Okay, so that's actually, we have solved quantum gravity in 3D. And probably tomorrow, what we're going to discuss is all the nice things you have to consider in 4D. Let me maybe shortly motivate the path integral and tell you that here you get basically lots of 6Js. And in this case, basically all these canonical and covariant approaches are the same. And I'm telling you to not to believe all these claims that, you know, the canonical approach is always not, cannot give you any result which is covariant. And they're basically these things, they do hang together, and unfortunately, one usually learns if you have a problem in the canonical approach, actually typically also exists in the covariant approach. Just you have to adjust things so that they are actually equivalent, and today we basically know that how to do that more or less. So here I'm giving you a sloppy derivation of the path integral. So at some point we actually had discussed, maybe let's do that in EA, the first order formulation, and this used to be E and A. And so as I hope you might remember, I should not write this in this form. The path integral would basically integrate over all fields, about the triad fields and the connection fields. And the problem is to actually specify this measure. Now, this thing would be something like FE, contracted with lots of indices here. Oops. So that's your manifold. And so you would have to integrate over all E's and over all connections. And if you ignore lots of things, it was really that even in the equation of motion, if you vary E, it imposes F equal to zero. So this, what you have standing here, is basically the delta function in F. And so here comes a huge heuristic step that, in fact, this path integral defines you actually the integral over all, one says basically it's the integral over connections. However, this delta functions impose you that you integrate over all flat connection. And again, this is completely undefined. I would have still to define the measure, and actually mathematicians kind of still try to, well, not mathematicians, I know physicists, you can to define it, for instance, in 4D. In 3D, I think it's quite clear what it is for all cases of Lie groups and topologies. In 4D, there are some weird cases where it's not very clear what it is. Okay, but what you can do is actually to discretize this path integral. And again, in this case of topological theories, that doesn't really matter. And so we put it on a lattice and discretize it. And we knew how to put our connection into holonomies now. So what you do is basically kind of choosing a triangulation. And actually, you choose a dual triangulation. And so that means that actually you would have in 3D a triangulation into tetrahedron, but if you have a dual triangulation, you put a vertex in each tetrahedron, and then you have an edge going through each triangle. So there are four edges, so you get these four valent vertices, which glue together. And so you can. They have certain specifics of these things, as we'll see in a minute. And so these dual triangulation, I cannot really draw this. They would also have faces. So these faces are the ones, so every edge of the triangulation goes through one face of the dual triangulation. And we know that we have holonomies, so G1, G2, G3, G4, G5, associated to the edges of the dual triangulation. And so for every face here, that's a face, the one which is punctured by this. We would have to impose the delta function in this holonomy, and the holonomy would be just product of all these g's. So this path integral, you can say it's that M would be basically defined now integral over all group elements associated to the edges, integral over all faces, delta functions, and the holonomies around this face. So that's the group delta function. And so that's quite a simple thing, integral over delta functions. And so now we rewrite that into something more impressive, because we are physicists and want to impress people. And that's basically making a Fourier transform and uses an exercise, which I've told you some time ago. And this exercise tells you that this delta function you can represent as the sum over characters of the group, and the character was defined to be just the sum over as a trace of this group element. Okay, now there's a 5-minute derivation of the thing. So now comes a lot of annoying rewriting, and you would have to be very careful with what is oriented in which way, which gives you minus signs and so on. So that's where I won't exactly reproduce that. So basically what one does is the character is just a trace over those matrix elements. These are evaluated here on the holonomy. Holonomy is a product over group elements. So you can write the trace over this holonomy as a product over all these matrix elements. So here you would basically contract everything into a cyclic trace. So you do that. And you have the sum here for every, you have a J for every phase of your dual triangulation, and every phase goes through one edge of the triangulation. And so now you have to basically collect, what you have want to do is to integrate over the group edges, over the group elements which are associated to the edges. So you have to collect all G's, all belonging to one edge. And one dual edge goes through a triangle. A triangle has three real edges. The three real edges define your three dual faces. So you actually have always three group elements there. Yeah, it's something. So there are always three of these. And they come with certain, you know, that's the annoying part, with certain indices. And the annoying part is that you would have to keep track of that. And then they might also come in different orientations. We would have keep to track of that, which we don't know, which we don't want to do because it's giving just lots of signs and these stars. And so you can check that up. And you remember certainly that we actually discussed what is the integral over these three group elements. And so we get the three J ensembles. And so this group integration would get rid of all these group integrations here. At the same time, you actually would put the summations here in front. So what you now have achieved is that you have rewritten your path integral into a sum over JF. And you have an F. F is a, you know, so actually it's a sum over all kind of real edges because F has the dual faces. And then we now have actually sum over all these magnetic indices because this is what we have here. We have not written explicitly the sum. And then we have a product over lots of 3J ensembles. And so now you can actually go further. So we had said every edge every edge goes, comes with these three. Every edge here comes with gives you basically these two 3GN thimbles. And then if an edge goes through there, through this triangle, you know, you usually forgot which way it was. So then there's one index associated to the tetrahedron and the other index to the other tetrahedron, which is between these things. And so nicely, one 3GN symbol gives you one tetrahedron, and the other 3GN symbol goes to the other tetrahedron. So guess what happens? So that means for every tetrahedron, you get four 3GN symbols and a certain contraction pattern. And now you go through it in detail and find that you get the 6J symbol. And basically, that's the result. So basically, there's you sum over all GF, and that's kind of, let me call that G real edges. And every tetrahedron, you know, has six edges. So you kind of have to name them as six edges, and I might possibly do that wrong because there's a certain rule of how to name these things. So then the dimension factors, which one has to collect for probably the, so far they were just associated to the, again, to the faces. Now to the real faces, to the triangles. And then for every tetrahedron, you have a 6J symbol, and then possibly you have some signs. And this gives you, in general, the path integral for 3D quantum gravity without cosmological constant, and that's called the Ponzano-Reche model. And this was actually kind of guessed in the 60s by Ponzano and Reche, as the name suggests, 64. And let's say kind of around in the early 90s, people realized, yeah, that's actually a realization of really a path integral if you would do that mathematically better defined and impose the thing. And so here we have basically this path integral for a general, which you can apply to a general manifold. And so you could also use it for a tetrahedron, for a torus times a torus, so a torus times a cylinder, or a kind of evolution of a torus. Or a torus times an interval, for instance, and you have to triangulate this. And actually, here you get lots of infinities a priori, which one would have to regularize. And it's not surprising that you got lots of infinities because at some point we started with all these delta functions. And we did not care whether these delta functions are kind of independent or not. So they, in general, they don't happen to be independent. And there's, again, a simple rule that basically for every vertex here, there's a Bianchi identity holding. Also, you can put a little sphere around every vertex here. That's called a bubble. And so for every vertex, you get at one independence. This simple rule holds for simple topologies, and it gets a bit more complicated for non-trivial topologies. as you can ask some experts. Okay, and this gives you basically the pars integral, and as I promised you, indeed, kind of this solution for the spherical stuff, for a spherical surface, defines you already basically the solution for this general, I mean, gives you a way to basically define amplitudes for general stuff, for a general manifold. So that's quite nice. And it's something which basically is also partially due to being topological. But this is one aspect which actually generalizes to some certain extent to 2,4-D. So probably, and tomorrow we will discuss things which one should do in 4D. Okay, thank you.